Hello, you're listening to Copy Time, a podcast series on markets and economies from DBS Group Research. I'm Tamir Beg, Chief Economist. Welcome to our 68th episode, the first one of 2022. It is tempting to begin the year with global macro. And trust me, there will be plenty of that in the forthcoming episodes. But today's episode takes its cue from a couple of riveting conversations I've had with Sarov Jain in the past year. Sarov is the founder of Connexio, a provider of human capital services to organizations across Asia with a key focus on the startup system. From each of the conversations that I had with Sarov over lunch in the last year or so, I've always come away with the feeling that something really interesting is going on in one particular area of Sarov's focus, which is India. The country scale, entrepreneurial tradition, problem-solving culture, and just the current global juncture of where markets and geopolitics stand make the startup proposition there a very compelling one. Sarov Jain is a chartered accountant and an alumnus of IIM Ahmedabad and Booth School of Business, University of Chicago. Before setting up Connexio back in 2017, Sarov spent 12 years at Deutsche Bank, where his last role was Chief Operating Officer for APAC Corporate Finance. Sarov, welcome to Copy Time.
Thank you very much, Timur. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I've been looking forward to this. Let's begin by talking about Connexio. Tell us a bit more about what it does and why did you set it up?
So as you mentioned earlier, Connexio is fundamentally an HR consulting firm with a focus on recruiting and other management consulting activities related to human capital. I set it up in 2017 to help plug gaps in how various human capital related matters were being attended to, both by large organizations as well as specifically the startup ecosystem, which back in the day was already starting to grow quite rapidly. From a personal perspective, I've had the good fortune to live and work in a number of different geographies, the continent, Europe, the Americas, Southeast Asia, and India. And after a corporate career of 15, 16 years, I really wanted to see if I could synthesize some of the experiences that I've had, bring them together and draw on them to help either executives in the large companies or founders or CXOs in the startup ecosystem to help them solve some of the issues that they were looking for, that they were addressing. That was the main reason why I actually set Connexio up about almost 5 years ago.
And how's it gone so far? How has it been running a business based out of Singapore, but with a lens that goes to South Asia and perhaps even beyond?
Yeah, no, you're right about beyond, because our ambit has grown. We now cover stuff across Asia. So starting with clients in the Middle East, through South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Hong Kong. Being based in Singapore and running a regional business, well, Singapore is probably the best place to be based in for a variety of infrastructural reasons. And then through COVID, like many other organizations, we've learned to adapt. We've learned to use technology. We've learned to build SOPs internally. The key thing that both me and my very high quality management team have focused on is to ensure that execution doesn't miss a beat. And so far, I'd like to believe that we've been fairly successful in that. Like I said, by using technology to support our business efforts.
But very soon, will you start traveling vigorously again?
For sure, 100%. I have already dipped my toe. I've been fortunate to be able to make a couple of trips recently to the Bay Area, where many of our investor clients are, and also to India. And yes, it's quite clear that although the nature of the future of work remains uncertain, and of course there are evangelists on both sides, the fact is that people have started engaging again personally, which is definitely critical for the world as it emerges from the pandemic.
So, sir, I want to talk to you about the Indian ecosystem momentarily, but since you were talking about future of work, let me pick your brain a little bit. So in the process of setting up companies, whether it is in Singapore or in South Asia or elsewhere, are employers trying to become more flexible, and how has that experience been during these 2 years of COVID? And by flexible, I mean, you know, work from home sort of thing.
I think it remains an evolving situation. I think to a large extent, the world, the certain parts of the world declared victory once Delta started dying down, and then Omicron came up. I think with Omicron, the acceptance that hybrid is here to stay for a while is starting to set in a little bit deeper. There are people still hesitating to call the complete end of full-time work, but at a more kind of grassroots or at a more practical level, there was definitely a move towards offices opening full-time and the expectation that employees would work full-time over, let's say, late Q2, early Q3, as the worst of Delta seemed to be behind us in the region in most countries. But now I think it's fair to say that that's firmly in the backseat, despite the acceptance that Omicron may not be as lethal as Delta. I think employers recognize that it's perhaps too early for full-time return to work. And we're definitely seeing a move back to at least hybrid, and in the case of especially MNCs, a return to work from home to some extent.
Okay, so let me, one more follow-up question. Saurabh, the idea of remote work is not new. My cousin in San Jose, way back in the early 1990s, worked for a global software development team where some of them were in India, some were in East Asia, some were in the US, across time zones, producing a product that then IBM marketed. How are these things or these recent developments any different from what my cousin used to do 30 years ago?
I think your cousin was then the exception, and it's now becoming increasingly the rule. The thing is, what we're seeing, especially in the developing countries in the region, is that changing the nature of work isn't just about putting boundaries around how and where you do your work from. It also means changes in how you live. It means changes in your domestic infrastructure. It means sometimes changes in the social dynamics within a family's home. And in parts of the world like Asia, where there are often multi-generational families living together, or there are certain preconceived notions about gender roles, et cetera, there are second order, third order impacts that I think are still being fleshed out by societies at large. It's not, work from home is not necessarily for all parts of society the holy grail, or at least not as consistently or in as wide ranging a manner here in Asia as it might be in certain developed countries.
No, makes sense.
All right. It's a much deeper conversation. I'm happy to come back for episode 73 to discuss that.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about the meat of our conversation. So let's get into India. You've spent quite a bit of time in the last few years working across various segments of the Indian talent pool. So why don't you get us going by giving us a little bit of idea about the supply of talent, the demand for talent, idiosyncrasies around India, the depth of skill that everybody talks about. So get us going with the Indian talent pool.
The Indian talent pool, as a well-known fact, is vast. That's the only word for it. It's absolutely vast. It's vast, it's wide. And I think the most interesting aspect of it is that it keeps auto-refreshing. It's very flexible. Every few years, people naturally upskill or reskill themselves to make themselves relevant for what is becoming an extremely dynamic working environment. I mean, tech is probably a great example of that. Till just a handful of years ago, the bulk of the demand in India was for IT services companies, the old majors, right? The companies like TCS, Wipro, Satyam, HCL, et cetera, on which the entire backbone of the Indian technology ecosystem has been built and for which the country is going to be eternally grateful. But if you look at what's happening nowadays, the technologies that the new startups are looking for and the kind of skills that they're looking for have evolved. because there is clearly a move from a high degree of demand for service-based skills to product company-based skills. And things like that are a pretty inexorable change and represent an upskilling of the overall workforce, which perhaps for the decade or so before that hadn't happened in as kind of conclusive a manner as it has now. In terms of demand, I think you'll find that almost any statistic you look at with respect to the startup ecosystem in particular, because that's what we want to focus on today. The number of jobs being created is absolutely massive. If you only look at the startups that are registered or within the ambit of government registration, there were a couple of hundred thousand jobs created last year. The true number, if you talk to any of the founders, and if you clean out the data, it's probably 4 to 5 times that just in the last year. And then if you look at the related ancillary jobs created, you multiply that by another 2 to 3 times. So you're potentially looking at perhaps as much as a job creation of 1 million just in the last 12 months by the startup ecosystem. Again, by government estimates, the number of white collar jobs expected to be created in the next year is about, again, between 150 to 200,000. And again, this is only by startups that are within the ambit of the government. There would be a whole bunch of other companies that may not be there. So in terms of both supply and demand, I think we're at a historic juncture. There will always be a degree of distortion. Sometimes the supply is too much, sometimes the demand is too much. But in terms of this becoming an ecosystem that is driving economic growth in India, this definitely is the most important growth factor right now.
Saro, help me confirm or dispel this notion that I have. My notion is that in the last 20 years, the orientation of the tech service industry in India has been transformed from one that was primarily export-oriented. So the TCSs that you're talking about, it was providing IT services to various global MNCs, and their investment was also about Indians working for an MNC to provide services to their customers in the US, Europe, wherever. And my notion is that it's changing as we speak, and some of the businesses that you are working with, they're actually looking at providing services to Indian customers earning revenue in India. Is that an accurate notion?
It most certainly is. And I think the second order impact of that also is that the relative attraction of working for the domestic sector as the startup ecosystem becomes more and more mature or becomes more and more pervasive is becoming stronger and stronger. The traditional concepts of job security, etc., jobs for life, which mattered so much to people coming to freshly minted employees coming out of engineering colleges, for example, that's not necessarily as much of a critical factor anymore, because the opportunities in the startup ecosystem, like you said, where you're servicing the domestic ecosystem, are absolutely humongous now. Also, I guess with the world becoming a more closed place, with many, many countries forcing or rather encouraging their businesses to hire locally and discouraging offshoring of jobs, that in a way has also supported the movement of tech talent towards the startup ecosystem.
Do you see a lot, because you said earlier that you have been to Bay Area as one of your first travel destinations for work. Yeah. So there is a lot of Indian entrepreneurs who have succeeded in the West and now they're bringing their capital or know-how back to India?
Yes, there is certainly a lot of that happening in multiple ways. There are a bunch of entrepreneurs whose businesses are fundamentally maybe US oriented or Europe oriented and are therefore not that well known in India, but who've already set up large tech centers or R&D centers in India. Now, because these companies are not household names, they're perhaps not as well known in India, or they work in fields which are perhaps not very large or not that well known in India. So there's already a lot of that happening. But what we've also seen, and what I've personally seen talking to a lot of senior founders and CXOs in the West, especially in the tech-enabled ecosystem, is that COVID has perhaps got many of them to start thinking about some of the longer term life priorities. And although obviously COVID was a terrible, terrible time for people globally, and the issues in India are well documented during the Delta wave last year, there's an increasing shift in mindset of people who thought they were going to be living abroad overseas and now want to come back to be closer to family, be closer to home. And also, frankly, over the last 2.5-3 years, just before COVID started and through COVID, because the Indian ecosystem has been so vibrant, I mean, $25 billion on average of investment coming in every year, which means that a lot of these guys say that, you know, we can build careers in India and be close to our families and to our native ecosystems. There's a lot of that going on right now. In fact, we're having multiple conversations with people in the Bay Area who want to explore opportunities back in India right now.
You know, Saurabh, when I was in college in the US, there were always two groups of people. You had the Southeast Asians, the Malaysians, Indonesians, Thais, who had no question of settling in the West. For them, they were there to study because they had comfortable lives and capital and job opportunities back home, and they were all going to come back. Whereas those of us from South Asia, we basically had only one thing in mind, which is to make the West our home. I'm so happy to see what you just described, which is that South Asia is becoming a bit like East Asia, that there is enough of an ecosystem that leaving home to go abroad to study does not become a one-way destination. It can be choose to stay there or choose to come back or do both through the course of your life.
Yes, and what is also further encouraging is that it's not limited just to people who have a very specific technical skill set, like they're technology professionals, nor is this limited just to people who maybe exited a startup and have huge amounts of capital and can financially not have to think twice about moving back and setting something up. We're also talking about mid-career people who are looking to see if they can transport the skills and the experience that they have back to India. And to be fair to the Indian senior management and founders, a lot of them are very open to talking to returning Indians to explore if their experiences can be transported back. So I do think that this is going to become a reasonably well-populated pipeline of talent returning Indians over the next, year or two.
Could you share us with a couple of examples of the scale and dynamism that we're talking about? Like when a startup CEO comes to you, is he or she asking you to help recruit 5 people, 50 people or more? And what kind of fields are they hiring and how are they sort of, how quickly are they moving about?
So I'm going to take the second part of that question first. Speed is, the speed at which these guys move is impressive. And I'm not suggesting they're moving fast just because they want to break a few things. They move fast, but they do good comprehensive evaluations of candidates, but they just move quickly because they just want to get operationalized really quickly. They're all under a lot of self-created pressure, but these are all driven people. These are all people who've made commitments to themselves, maybe to their stakeholders, that they're going to get to certain points in certain periods of time. There is increasingly a lot of competitive pressure in any niche that you might be operating in India. So they definitely move quickly. They move fast, they move decisively. In terms of the scale, again, harking back to the data that I mentioned earlier, the average new startup in a year, and I'm talking about the entire spectrum from completely bootstrapped ones to others that obviously, that might have raised a lot of money. On average, if you say about 50,000 startups got registered last year, the average hiring per startup is maybe 10 to 15 in a year. However, the key thing to keep in mind over here is that a lot of these startups are raising between, say, anything between 20, 30 million and 100, 150 million, or even more in some cases, of seed capital, which means that on day one, they have the ability to have a fully functional organization in place, as opposed to an organization that will grow organically over time as they grow. And these kinds of startups are potentially hitting the ground running with, you know, 100, 200, 300 employees in the first quarter of operation, which if you think about it, you're going from getting your first dollar into the bank to having a fully functioning revenue generating organization within 3 months with a couple of 100 people. That is quite an impressive task. And our we have founders that we work with who are completely up to this challenge. It's such impressive people.
Sarab, if you have thousands of startups coming to life every year and each trying to hire 10, 20 people, leading to hundreds of thousands of people getting employed, that also means there's tremendous competition for talent. So how are you advising these employers to keep their talent sticky? Because I hear a lot about attrition, which is not India specific, all over the world, that's an issue. Yeah. And so, but how are Indian entrepreneurs sort of dealing with this challenge?
The reality is that there's a lot of money chasing a very large talent pool, but there is a lot of money chasing it right now. So there is in the current environment going to be a higher degree of churn than is perhaps ideal for the ecosystem. But what I think increasingly our founders in India have started internalizing is that people don't just leave companies, people often leave their managers. And it's really heartening to see that the same ecosystem, which a couple of years would have brushed off any talk about, say, organizational culture or internal processes, these same founders are now at many times either institutionalizing such things, or even when they're starting to build their companies, they actually talk to their investors or to advisors like us for support on how they can start the ball rolling by putting a vision statement in place, by putting organizational objectives in place, by putting the framework of culture in place. And the companies that are doing this, rather than just growing by throwing money at people and attracting talent, are often being more successful at having a lower churn rate. I'm not for a moment judging those who feel the pressure to hire really quickly, because very often the decisions are driven by all kinds of external factors which are not in your control. But the companies that are able to set a framework in place on day one in terms of how they want to build their organizations, not just their business, are invariably the ones with materially lower churn rates.
Share with us your perspective on some of the fast-growing sectors in India where the most amount of capital is going or the most amount of disruption or innovation is taking place. Like, I have in mind old economy sectors like health, education, commerce. Tell me how those sectors are getting disrupted and if there are other sectors that you find compelling, you know, share with us that too.
So the three that you named, or the three or four most popular ones that come to mind immediately: fintech, edtech, health tech, e-commerce, of course, they're there. But I think if we dig a little deeper in some of these, what are some of the really interesting companies in this space trying to achieve? And I think that's important because a lot of the work that some of these companies do also helps to give a lot of credibility to the entire ecosystem, to show that there's a world beyond just super rich founders and table tennis tables in the offices and things like that, right? Now, if you look at fintech, for example, one of the great things that has happened through the entire boom over the last 2-3 years is the amount of financial inclusiveness that has been developed. You know, credit being made available to people who were till now considered unbankable, concepts like payday loans. Now, of course, they come with their own sets of risks. I'm not denying that for a moment. But the fact that they now exist in the ecosystem, conversations they're having about these, transactions are happening, and the regulators are beginning to wake up and see what they can do to provide a balance between the demand for such services and the inherent risks that come with them. The fact that these conversations are happening, these businesses are starting, are definitely, it's a force for good for the economy. Just to jump to another sector that you mentioned, you talked about education. Now, there are the very well-known areas over here, you know, areas like test prep, et cetera, which fundamentally are meant to take good students and make them even better. Or things like academic counseling in terms of providing information and access to students for, you know, based on how they've done, what kind of careers they should choose, etc. But then there are companies that are working at a much more grassroots level, which are not always associated with the startup ecosystem, which are so interesting. I mean, there's one that I just want to name and talk about. There's a company called Lead Schools, which is headquartered out of Mumbai. What these guys do is that they focus on schools and students, which either are from underprivileged parts of society or from tier two, tier three cities, where the access to quality education could potentially be a challenge. And what these companies like these do is that, and Leap is a market leader in this space, they onboard such schools onto their platform. They've onboarded thousands of schools, and then they provide a standardized quality of education, a holistic academic experience for children across studies and other things by standardizing the curriculum, standardizing teacher training, providing standardized infrastructure, as a result of which kids who otherwise might have struggled to have access to quality education know that by going to a certain branded institution, they can have a certain basic quality of education, which was just not available earlier. The point I'm trying to make over here is that it's not just about big valuations and the stuff that you see on TV every day. There are also companies working to actually make a difference. And these are the ones that I feel that are really adding validation to the entire startup ecosystem. If you look at agritech, that's another area that doesn't get talked about a lot, but is becoming more and more important. There are companies currently that are working on removing various disruptions and various intermediary layers at various points of the value chain in agriculture, making it easier for farmers to go to market, making it cheaper for them, and removing various inefficiencies in the marketplace, right? But these are, again, not necessarily companies that get a lot of bandwidth, but they're making a huge difference in parts of India that really need this.
And on the health side, any interesting developments you're seeing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, of late, a lot of the developments, a lot of it has been about creating access, right? I mean, the number of people who have used these services, the health tech services in the last year in India to access very specific components of care, be it ambulances, be it telehealth, be it advice on COVID-related issues, that's just off the charts. But then what this ecosystem has also allowed people to do is medical health professionals like scientists, for example, who have an idea about developing a very specific, say, cancer marker test, which in isolation, if developed and used correctly, can either significantly reduce the cost of testing that a patient might need to undergo otherwise, or maybe even change the entire route, the entire treatment route, in terms of making it clear whether surgery is needed or not needed, et cetera. Things like this are also coming up all the time right now. And it's very good to see, you know, some of the traditional investors, the big name VC firms, are also investing very heavily in this kind of space, which is, again, I know from having worked with some of these companies, making a huge difference in the lives of cancer patients.
In this two-year COVID pandemic saga, are there any major examples of the entrepreneurs in India coming together with the government and helping solve some of the problems that have been posed by this pandemic?
For sure. And again, you know, you talked about scale and dynamism earlier, and I think it's such a huge validation of the kind of contribution this ecosystem is making. You know, for example, when Arogya Setu, the Indian test and trace app, was created, I think it must have been about 1.5 or close to 2 years ago, a bunch of India's leading startup founders got together with various government arms to brainstorm and help build this app out. So there's been a huge contribution from the ecosystem, from the startup founders to that. And it just goes to show, you know, what used to be perhaps thought of as a bunch of college kids just going down a rabbit hole, the same ecosystem now has a seat at the table. And increasingly, you know, they're being consulted in matters of policy, in all kinds of issues that are coming up at a state or central government level, which you can't ignore them anymore.
Really fascinating. I just want to go back to a very personal context of yours. So you went to IIM Ahmedabad. I'm pretty sure from your graduating class majority of the students went overseas to pursue a career initially. Whether they came back or not is a different story. Do you think that dynamism is changing because of the activity that you were sort of alluding to, that even for an IIM grad, there is a job that is interesting enough, that has remuneration substantial enough to remain in India?
I think there's another angle to it as well. I think when you're talking about an earlier generation of students, I think the West was seen as relatively inaccessible and therefore very aspirational. Mm. As you mentioned earlier as well, people from Southeast Asia were going there to just study. People from South Asia were usually going there to try and move. I think increasingly what we're seeing is even kids who do want to go abroad more for the experience and the exposure, but are not necessarily treating the West as the holy grail of, you know, once I go there, there's no way I'm coming back. And in addition to some constraints that have been imposed by developing countries in terms of immigration, et cetera, I think the bulk of it boils down to the ecosystem that has been built back home, exactly as you were saying. If you can be part of a growth story in an exciting startup set up by people that you can relate to, who might be 4 or 5 years senior to you, have a similar background as yours, and can intellectually stimulate you to the same degree. And if the growth that you can now see in your career is no different from the growth that you would have in a Bay Area startup, and you're working in your native ecosystem, it's not obvious anymore at all that you should live, 10,000 miles away from home.
Speaking of the ecosystem,
you see that. Sorry.
Right. No. Absolutely. So speaking of that ecosystem, how open is that ecosystem to skilled professionals from overseas?
Very open. Like I was saying earlier, there is increasing interest in coming back to India for mid and late career professionals. And founders or CXOs in India are always open to having conversations with people who want to come back to India to see if the exposure they've had, the experience they've had, the skills they've built up would be value additive to their companies in India. We haven't had, I think, even a single instance of somebody who's interested in coming back to India and hasn't been able to have really interesting and informed conversations with potential employers in India. In fact, if I may, I want to just take this opportunity to also flip this around a little bit. A lot is said about returning South Asians, but what interestingly we've also started seeing that within the region, there is now interestingly increasing demand for South Asian startup professionals from companies outside of India, like in Southeast Asia or in the Middle East. As those startup ecosystems start growing rapidly, well, Indonesia has been growing rapidly for a while, but as they start catching up with India and they start solving more and more of the same problems that people solved in India, they want to talk to and potentially employ people from India to see if they can help them solve the same problems outside. And this is not related to just tech talent. This is also people from marketing, growth, finance, investor relations, all of that. So I think it's a true validation of how well the ecosystem has grown, in that there's returning talent from overseas, but it's also exporting a lot of talent overseas now.
And what about non-Indians? Are they also showing up more and more? By that, I mean, are Indian startups or even like more advanced companies subjecting their top leadership to sort of global competition?
There is definitely interest in that, especially at the complete top end of the unicorn list. COVID has definitely thrown a spanner in that, at least for the time being, because global mobility has in general been a little limited. As we emerge from the pandemic, I'm already seeing the first stirrings of interest in that again from Indian companies. And I'm reasonably confident that that comes back. But there is definitely openness. I think you have to say that about the Indian ecosystem. They are open to all kinds of ideas and thoughts. They're typically not constrained by things like pedigree or years of experience or any of the other usual filters that are applied in traditional recruitment situations. They're far more open, far more flexible, and they look for the value that an individual can add, as opposed to necessarily what letters he has next to his name.
sort of the Indian markets, private or public, have gone through an extraordinary boom in the last 18 months or so. So it's a strange juxtaposition. We have the pain inflicted by the pandemic, but we also have record liquidity, record investment coming in, and you know the record number of unicorns taking place in India last year. 2020 is very likely to be characterized by higher interest rates and less liquidity. And in the first few weeks of the year, we've already seen, whether it is in India or in the US, significant market volatility. So what kind of risks do you see in the horizon as this era of cheap cash starts coming to an end?
I think if you're talking about India in particular, India benefits a little bit by the fact that it already has a very well-developed platform. The ecosystem has already been validated by the amount of success it's had. 70, 80 unicorns and many times that number in the $500 million to $1 billion bracket. So in terms of international investment and the number of alternatives are perhaps not that high because there have been disruptions in various countries where money also used to flow over the last couple of years, such as China. So interest rates going up to the extent that will cause a little bit of a liquidity, will cause a significant liquidity crunch in general. I'm not sure that makes a huge impact yet on the Indian startup ecosystem, because the Indian startup ecosystem is getting very integrated into the fabric of daily society. It's like we were talking earlier, you know, things like healthcare, things like education, things like financial inclusion. These are undergoing complete transformations because of the force for good that the Indian startup ecosystem has fundamentally become. And which is why its growth is fundamentally, I think, not going to be altered by normal economic cycles. Of course, it will be impacted to some extent. But when people talk of risks in the context of the startup ecosystem, they're looking for a 1999 style internet bust where the ecosystem was ravaged, completely ravaged. What the companies in India are doing in terms of solving fundamental issues of access, of infrastructure, of democratizing things like quality and education, these I don't think are going to get slowed down because of economic cycles. But when you talk of risks, if I may, what I talk about with some of my founder friends is that the risks might be as much internal as external. One of the closest parallels I can think of is around the GFC, when a number of financial institutions were completely transformed as a result of their actions before the GFC. Now, if you hindsight is always 2020, and without pointing any fingers at any individuals or any institutions, the fact is that if you look through all the literature, and there's been plenty written about what happened during that period, if you kind of deep dive into it, a lot of it boils down to two things: hubris and lack of internal controls, or weak internal controls. And that's what I think our founders, our external stakeholders all need to keep an eye out for, to make sure that hubris doesn't get ahead of itself or doesn't impact how the companies are being organized, how they're performing. And very importantly, not handing over internal controls as somebody else's problem within the company, making how you look at your control framework as something very fundamental to how you do business. If you have these two things in check, I think internally, most of the key risks should get taken care of.
So I think those two factors apply both at the micro as well as the macro national level. So I think your point is very, very well taken. Saurabh, thank you so much for your time and insights. This was really, really interesting.
Thank you very much, Timur. Pleasure being over here. Look forward to catching up soon.
Absolutely. And let me thank also our listeners. Kopi Time was produced by Martin Taki. Daisy Sharma and Violet Lee provided additional assistance. It is for information only and does not represent any trade recommendation. All 68 episodes of Kopi Time are available on YouTube as well as on all major platforms, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. As for our research publications, webinars, and live streams, you can find them all by Googling DBS Research Library. Have a great day.